right. So as I put in the newsletter, today's talk is about practicing with fear. And I'm going to talk about some stuff that may arouse some fear, but then we will be moving on from that. And so hopefully you will walk away from this talk feeling strengthened. So I am a Democrat. I won't deny that. But I would never give a talk at Brightway Zen before an election endorsing a Democratic candidate. We gather as a Sangha to practice and celebrate our common values: generosity, kindness, compassion, ethical behavior, wisdom. And I would argue, I mean, you could disagree with me, but that in keeping with those values, that we all also have a responsibility as individuals to engage in our political process. If you define politics as a set of activities associated with making decisions in groups or other forms of power relations among individuals, such as the distribution of resources or status. So, in other words, arriving at answers to the questions, what should we do, is politics. I think we can all kind of associate politics with like certain aspects of politics, which are annoying or corrupt or whatever. Power plays and what have you. But essentially, at its core, it's about, okay, here we have this group of people, a community, a city, a state, a country, a Zen center, whatever. What should we do as a group? And how do we come up with that decision? Who makes those decisions? What's the process for that? So, if we don't pay attention, if we don't participate in political processes, we're just neglecting our moral responsibility to influence those decisions. Just kind of washing our hands of it, even though you can't really. You're part of that group, whether you like it or not. So if you just kind of, relegate your responsibility to others and let them make the decision, well, that's also a political decision. Surely the sphere of our practice and values isn't limited to our personal lives. But in Sangha, we encourage people to be politically engaged, whatever that means for you, without getting into how that engagement should look. That would mean we would be prioritizing politics, like we want the decisions to be made this way or this decision to be made. Prioritizing that over our main purpose, which is coming together to support one another in Dharma practice, which I would argue is beneficial no matter one's political beliefs, right? So even if there was somebody in the Sangha you disagreed with wholeheartedly and you thought they had wrong views and whatever, I mean, Dharma practice presumably will just help. Right? Will help them be the best person they can be. So, just as I kind of wade into momentarily into some political territory here, I just want to share that my vision for the Sangha is that someday when we express ourselves within Sangha about political issues, that we always speak as if there was someone of the opposing view present. That doesn't mean we should shut up, right? That doesn't mean we shouldn't state what our position is or what we think to be true, but we phrase it in a different way, right? If there's somebody overhearing us, we're not just going to say, oh, that, yeah. We're going to be conscious of the fact that that's not actually going to be helpful. That's going to cause aggression or defensiveness or alienate or whatever. So thoughtful speech. So all that said, there comes a time when standing up for our values means opposing a particular piece of legislation or a particular candidate. It was many years ago. There was a measure. I forget what it was, but it was a very anti-gay measure that was in Oregon, and that was one of the rare times that Kogan and Gokoko came out publicly against something. As many people wonder, our 501c3 tax exempt status means we cannot officially endorse candidates. But that does not mean we can't speak about issues. So, practicing with fear, it is a 50-50 chance that on Tuesday, our country will elect someone who incited an insurrection against our legitimately elected government in 2021 and has never backed down from defending that act. If he loses on Tuesday, it is extremely unlikely he will accept that. Trump has deliberately fomented fear, hatred, and racism against immigrants. He has threatened violence against those who disagree with him. He has promised to cripple parts of our government that look after the welfare of all people, regardless of income or origin. He's promised to roll back attempts our government has made to address the climate crisis and prevent new attempts. So none of this is just a simple disagreement about policy, right? About approach, which like a Democrat, Republican versus Libertarian might think, the best outcome we get this way, the best outcome we get that way. But all of this is really just like destructiveness. It's just negativity and destructiveness. So it's hard for us to imagine a fascist America, even though we know in theory it's possible. There are plenty of other places where it's arisen, where the people are good, just like you and me. But then they found themselves in a fascist or totalitarian regime. So one encouraging thing is that there's more than one way to define democracy. And democracy is like, okay, I mean, the populace being able to elect leaders and influence decisions is a big part of it, like voting, democratic representation. But another big part of it is tolerance for dissent. Right now in America, we still have greater tolerance for this than just about any country in the world. Well, we shouldn't take that for granted either, right? Should keep an eye out for that. Tolerance for dissent. And reportedly, Trump has asked his advisors before whether it is okay to fire on protesters. In other words, we have reasons to be fearful right now. Each of us reacts differently. For some of us, it might be kind of morbid obsession, right? Just like if you drive by and you have to look at the car accident, right? Like they just have to kind of go home and see like what horrible, like how bad is it today? Just you kind of could keep your eyes on the enemy, just keep informed, right? Like stay up to date on things. Some of us, we just need to avoid or ignore it. I'm definitely at the point now where I'm like, I'm still canvassing. I've voted. Like there's nothing else I can do to influence this election. So I don't want to look. I can't stand it. I start to get just agitated the moment that I start to overhear. And my husband listens to news all day long, right? So he's like, oh, I'm just like, ah. Right. So and sometimes we're just like, it's difficult to, explore the depths of our fear or whatever. So how do we practice with fear when what is causing the fear is not imaginary? So I would argue that we take the same three steps that we take to address dukkha of any kind. So I am Many of you will be familiar. I've been doing a podcast episode on this. I kind of talked about this in a previous Dharma talk. The practice intensive group is studying it. So it's kind of the theme right now. So in the case of fear, how does that relate to dukkha, right? So dukkha is existential angst we add on top of painful or uncomfortable or stressful experiences. So I would argue, and a great metaphor for this or analogy, whichever, is that of the two arrows. So if you're shot with an arrow, ow, you feel pain, and that's, there's no getting around that. There's some pain. But what we tend to do is shoot ourselves or stab ourselves, if you will, with a second arrow. Like, oh no, am I going to get better? Am I going to, like who shot this arrow? Oh my God. Like there's all kinds of ways that we resist or lament or make things worse. And that is a mental activity. That is something we add to the experience. So in the case of, in this case, the first arrow is circumstances that cause us pain, distress, worry, fear at a basic level. And we can acknowledge that, and there's nothing a lot that we can do about that. And when we're just really with that experience, there's a sense in which it can be okay. It's not pleasant. It's still pain or distress or worry or whatever, but it is just kind of what it is. There's a simplicity to it, a cleanness to it. We can feel kind of grounded even as we feel it, right? That we can just, like, I am really afraid for the state of my country right now. And that is a very natural thing to feel at this moment. So some amount of fear is appropriate and helpful, right? To like, oh, maybe I should do something. Maybe there's something that needs to be addressed. But the second arrow, that existential angst we add to our experience, making it much worse, it feels different. It feels like it's resistance, it's clenching, it's trying to deny or fight against the way that things are in this moment. And we can work on minimizing this response, catastrophizing, horror, inability to accept the current state of affairs, imagining worst case scenarios, that kind of thing. And it's not that in doing this is not in some senses natural, or it isn't that it's bad or sinful or anything like that. It's just that we can do something about it. This is the part that we can do something about. So we can choose. I mean, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to, just choose not to respond in a way that causes dukkha, but we have some chance. We have some chance of becoming aware of it and maybe seeing through it and maybe letting some of it go, et cetera. So there are three components to our addressing dukkha. One is maximizing our overall spiritual health. Two is managing symptoms. And three is addressing its ultimate cause. So there's three components to our practice. And a lot of times people get really like they only when they you think of practicing with fear, for instance, many of us only think of that number two, managing symptoms. So when I emphasize these three different aspects, so one, maximizing our overall spiritual health. I mean, and there's no, we take a holistic approach to this practice, right? Get enough sleep, eat well, exercise, maintain your supportive relationships, sit zazen, come to Sangha, whatever, like whatever it is that helps you stay healthy and stable and balanced and grounded or whatever it is. So there's that is a very important aspect of it. So two, managing symptoms. So Buddhism has all kinds of tools that we can use for managing our symptoms, our dukkha symptoms, our fear symptoms, our anger symptoms. And it's very rich practice for this, but it doesn't, we don't have to limit ourselves in any way to, anything officially Buddhist. Really, the Buddhist line is become mindful of what is happening in your mind and body, and then explore. Is there anything you can do to affect the situation? So requires that element of mindfulness, noticing what we are feeling, noticing what triggers it or makes it worse or tends to help. We like to say it's the shift between I am angry or I am fearful to I am experiencing anger right now. I am experiencing fear right now. So there's a degree of disidentification with it that allows us to acknowledge that this is a conditional experience. This is a temporary experience. This is an experience that we can affect. You might notice what rabbit holes you go down that allow you to kind of perpetuate whatever it is, anxiety or fear or anger. What external sources tend to make it worse. Like I said, the maybe overexposing yourselves to certain kinds of media might not be helpful. And this is, for each individual, we have to decide how much from this example do we need to keep ourselves informed and how much is, okay, that's enough, excess. So it's mindfulness all the way along. We can manage symptoms by centering ourselves in the body, by concentrating on our breathing, by taking a walk, trying to be very simple and present in our body. In this moment, there is much to be grateful for. In this moment, we are safe and healthy. So that can kind of balance the, going off into fear and anxiety. We can redirect the mind. There's a lot of Buddhist practices which involve this. Gratitude practice is a wonderful one. Metta practice, wishing goodwill, calling people to mind and wishing them goodwill. Just kind of move the mind out of negative tracks, doing some kind of positive activity. Sometimes we can reason with ourselves in a little, to notice what it is that is going on in our mind, and for instance, remind ourselves that you can't control any of this, right? So you maybe you can let yourself let it go. A very important one in Buddhism is noble friendship and conversation. So being around other people who help us, I don't know, cultivate the state of mind and heart and body that we want, as opposed to perhaps being around people who, just help us become more angry, fearful, judgmental, whatever. And just to experiment. Anything can work. So I will, let's see, we have a half an hour. Because at one point I was going to just invite people to, yeah, let's do it now. So I'm gonna save time though for addressing the ultimate cause, which might not be what you think. But in terms of this managing symptoms, I was hoping that some Sangha members might have had some luck on practicing with fear or whatever it is that tends to come up for you around our political situation right now, and how you have ways you've found to practice with it that help alleviate some of the dukkha. If you're in the cloud, you can raise your electronic hand down under reactions. Leah.
I take a walk in nature, in the forest.
Leah takes a walk in nature.
There's no politics in the forest.
No politics in the forest.
Not right now.
Greg.
Yeah, I talk about this a lot, but I'm a rock climber and like I practice with fear a lot for fun. It's useful in the rest of your life, obviously. I mean, like the skills that you gain on the wall, like you can definitely take back into your real life, just like we try to be ordained into our lives with Zen. But you can be kind of ordained in your life with rock climbing too. It definitely is a place to work out a lot of emotional and mental issues for sure. But the one thing that I really have learned as a rock climber is like the fear is kind of essential to survival. If I am not like, there's a certain amount of irrational fear that we all have, whether we're rock climbing or watching the news about things that are never going to hurt us. But the fear has a biological purpose, and that is to let us know that something's going wrong. And so it's really important in my hobby to be able to distinguish between those two types of fear. Like, is this a rational fear or is there something seriously wrong right now? And when I feel fear, I have to look down at my knot on the rope that's connecting me to my partner who's keeping me safe. I have to look at the situation, the physical situation around me, the rocks. Is the rock I'm holding loose? Am I going to pull it out and hit myself with it or hit my partner with it? Those types of things. So I don't know, like, and fear can be a rush too. Like fear is definitely something we have our maybe it's the sixth precept about not becoming intoxicated. And I definitely like use fear as a drug sometimes and get high on it. And there's and that's probably the reason that I keep rock climbing. And that's not necessarily the healthiest thing to do, but like I do it with the news too. Like I'm like kind of binging on NPR and like getting angry and outraged at all of these different things. And that's extremely irrational. I have no control over what's going on in the world out there or what's being reported on the news. I can vote, but like that's one person doing one thing one time. So being able to tell like when I'm about to crash my car because I'm so outraged by what I'm hearing on NPR that I'm not paying attention to what's around me versus being afraid of a political candidate that I'm listening about are two different things. So for me, it's just really helpful to really think about what you're afraid of and whether you need to be afraid. Because if you do, then you can really benefit from that fear. But usually the fear is just, I'm up here really high and it's so scary, but all my systems are in check. So stop being so scared. This is just, you're high on a rock, but you're physically safe. You're not going to get hurt. So just those are the
Thank
lessons.
you. Thank you very much. It's a lot in there. So then go and then Courtney.
maybe this is just me. And thinking about unresolved dharma from Sajiki, but having difficult days, I often shift gratitude towards the difficulty of the day because a difficult day is where the opportunity for practice arises. That the practice of Zen was never built around surviving perfect days. It was built around surviving really awful days. And when awful days totally arise, which they will, I try to say, thank you for the opportunity to practice.
That definitely, it reminds me of the fact that, you know, when I start to go into catastrophizing mind and I just think like, shit, everything is just going to fall apart. Like, I'm like, what would still be true, right? Like, the practice would still be something to rely on. We would still get together as a Sangha. We would still, like, no matter what happens, like, that's something that we can rely on. The practice doesn't change, like you said, on circumstances. Sometimes people ask me, like, you know, what is the relevance of our practice for somebody off in a war zone or, you know, in these incredibly difficult places in our world? And it's like, it is not our place to tell those people, like, well, you would feel better if you just practiced Zen, right? That's like, it's not, but if they want to practice, like, the practice is the same. It may be much more difficult. It might be simpler. It might actually be easier in some ways when things are really difficult. Be like, focus on the practice. Courtney.
Yeah, I keep thinking, like, probably 4 years ago, I was about this time, I was worked up into a frenzy and I was very worried and anxious. And I was talking to my husband and I was like, aren't you worried? Like, because he just seemed to want me to calm down. And I was like, aren't you worried? Aren't you worried? And he said to me, like, well, there's nothing I can do about it. Like, I don't have that much influence. There's nothing I can do. So why would I worry about it? And I was so mad at him for that flippant attitude. But I have to say that since then, the phrase that I've learned here is that I am not holding the world together with my mind. And that is my mantra these days. Like, my worry is not changing anything.
Mm.
Because I really felt like I needed to hold on to that so things would be okay. And so that thought, and so I, with apologies to him, I think it's the same thing.
Thank you very much. Mark.
I don't find myself much affected by fear this time, knock on wood. What I find myself thinking is, there's this trope in sci-fi and fantasy, right? The good guys have to hold off the overwhelming evil every single time. Evil only needs to win once, but it's nonsense. Maybe I'll get the outcome I want and there'll be a next thing that needs to be done. Maybe I won't get the outcome I want and there will still be a next thing that needs to be done. And I find myself coming back around to the fact that it's really unsatisfying to say life goes on, but if you turn it upside down and you say going on is life, then there's this sort of sense of, well, whatever comes, I'm going to know what I need to do next. Seems like I always do. And I can put some faith in that. So that's how I'm dealing with it.
Thank you very much.
Delmio, thank you for this Dharma talk today. Such wisdom. I fall back on nothing succeeds like success. So actually in our modern times, we can find examples of people who would model for others if they're in a group. I'm sure parents do that all the time. I know I did as a teacher, and sometimes in a family situation. It doesn't mean you're not acknowledging the fear, but for others, you're saying, okay, I can hold this space right now of calm in the chaos. And then you can feel at least sometimes a shift of acceptance and people seeing a gestalt in the moment. So I appreciate you bringing this forward and the principles that, you know, Zen has shared with us over the eons. It's not surprising to me when I started to work with alcoholics and doing my internship and grad school, all these Zen quotes would pop up. Really? Chop wood, carry water. You don't have to think about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruthann. So I don't know how all of this is, you know, I wish I could just like see a little window into every person's mind and see how you hear this talk and whatever, but I know that for myself, I have been and still feel like each of us should take much more responsibility for our situation than we tend to. And I am very wary of spiritual practices preaching passivity. Like, let's all just find a way to make ourselves feel better. Because all that really matters is that we feel better. And then we don't have to do anything about the situation, right? And I'm like, like when your husband are like, nothing I can do. It's like, yes, there is something you can do. Yes, there's always something you can do, you know. You know, so it's taken me a long time to like make my peace with the teachings, because I needed to make sure every step along the way that they weren't, you know, pointing me toward that bullshit. So I'll just say like how I kind of came to terms with this is, so I guess I felt like I resisted letting go, you know, letting go of that, that fear or that anger or that compulsion, or letting go of my sense of what is right and wrong, even momentarily, right? Just to like take the medicine of emptiness. I didn't want to take that medicine of emptiness and have it result in me no longer feeling responsible or compassionate. But, you know, having taken the medicine of emptiness, I realize it doesn't change a thing. Or the only thing that it changes is this shit falls away. And you are still there. You're still compassionate. You still know everything that you know. You're still able to make decisions. You're still able to discern, but actually even more so, because you aren't caught up in your own stuff, your own defensiveness, your own fear, right? So it's much more likely to be able to respond appropriately. I mean, the big realization for me was, you know, when I'm kind of struggling against the teachings and I'm like, but I can't give this up. And then I looked at myself and I'm like, even though I had been holding together the world with my, you know, holding off all the evil with my mind all my life, I'm like, what are you actually doing? You're not doing anything, nothing. Like with all this stuff, are you actually doing anything? Are you trying to help? Are you trying to make anything different? And the answer for me was essentially no. So clearly this was not helping. So tried to let it go. And then, you know, it's still not an easy question as to what we can do. That's a whole nother thing to contemplate. But yeah. Anything more about practicing with fear or anxiety or resentment or judgment. Koji.
I'm kind of in a dilemma because I just moved here from California, so I'm not really registered here, and I was, you know, absentee ballot there. They weren't able to get it to me somehow.
Oh, no.
The address. So I'm just, you know, a few days away where I feel like I should be voting, but it's kind of, you know, I have called different places. And I'm just wondering if maybe I could do it online. Anyway, I'm still trying to figure it out till the last minute. But at the same time, I'm just coming to terms with I might not be able to vote this year. And so I just thought, well, I could, you know, I often just, you know, pray about or chant about different things, just really get into the space at home and create an intention, you know. So I thought, well, I can really just move some things with that. I feel I have in the past. And I just saw Wicked the other day. So I just feel like if I can't physically get out there and put my vote in for California, California is probably, you know, got good intentions. I'll just sit at home with the intention of making that shift happen.
Thank you. And that reminds me, we forgot to announce. Tuesday, we'll have election vigil, Dirt and Cloud. So instead of having a class, which to me would just feel very just like, why are we sitting here having a class when this is going on?
Yeah.
We're going to sit three periods of Zazen, and then at 8:30 have somebody check the news. We may or may not know anything at that point. In 2016, we did. And then we'll have a council circle, which everyone will have an opportunity to just speak from the heart. You don't have to, you can pass. So those in the Dirt Zendo and in the Cloud Zendo are welcome to join us for that.
Great, that sounds perfect. Thank you.
And if you participate for that duration from 7 to 8:30, there's no check in the news. There's no check in the media. If you are at home and somebody else in the house is doing that and you can't help but overhear it, just don't let us know. Although if we see you start to cry or we see you jump up and down, we might guess something. I don't know. Ellen.
We have a community gathering tomorrow night, the night before the election, here in our little town. And the idea, and it's actually, I'm one of the organizers. The idea was to promote a free, fair, safe election without violence. And it's not that I feel that we're necessarily in danger of that in my community, although it would be naive for me to think it couldn't happen. But in planning all of this, I thought in terms of, you know, fear and the, am I the one who's being naive and thinking that we could have some unity in hoping that there won't be violence or, you know, violent dissent about the election process and democracy. You know, just, you might be someone who votes for a person that I cannot wrap my head around it, but can we somehow come together to agree that we need to preserve democracy? Or is that a naive concept at this point? Like, we're not going to understand each other, but can we at least not create?
Yeah, I mean, I was one of the late night comedians that's how I've been getting my updates lately, because that's all I can take, right? Is their little end of the day commentary with a little laughter thrown in. But I think it was, I can't remember which one of them said, you know, if Trump wins, we will accept that because that's democracy, like it or not, right? And I felt like that was a really moving thing to realize that, like, it might be, you know, if that's the way the vote turns out, we are not going out with guns to defy that. So I guess we can at least teach by example. Yoli, did you have something more? No. I just thought you'd
bring things in my brain back.
Okay. I will go on. I will go on to
physical hand raiser.
Who? Yes. Let me move on, and if there's time at the end, any if you still have something to say, please raise your hand. Okay, so addressing the ultimate cause of our fear. And it may seem strange to say that the fear does not come from outside. Right? That I mean we so there's absolute and relative, right? In the relative sense. Like Greg was talking about, sometimes there are causes for fear, and it's a natural thing, and it's informative, and we should pay attention to it. So it's not like there's never any cause. We're saying there's never any cause for that kind of fear. But ultimately, you may recall from the Heart Sutra, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. So prajnaparamita being the perfection of wisdom, which is essentially insight into the emptiness of self and all things. When we see this, there is no fear. And I think of this as it's a different kind of fear. We might feel an immediate fear, you know, because there's something threatening us in our environment. That's kind of natural fear. This is more of existential fear, which we jump right there, right? If we are threatened, if especially physically, we jump right to existential fear of like our survival and who am I and like threatening my well-being, etc. So when we are still clinging to the idea of a inherently existing, enduring self nature, as opposed to embracing emptiness. This analogy rose in my mind. And I feel like I'm doing this in the true spirit of Kjogan Carlson, whose analogies were always, they worked, but they were really inelegant. They were kind of like, okay, I guess. But so here's Jade, true to his memory. So you're clinging to, you're in the ocean, and you are firmly ensconced in an inner tube. And so you're floating, but you're clinging to a small rock that's jutting out of the ocean. And you're convinced that like, I have to keep hold of this rock to survive. And the ocean's buffeting you and a storm is coming and you're trying to hold on to this little rock. When you let go, and then you realize like you can stay afloat, but now you're just in the ocean, right? Now you have nothing to hold on to, and you just have to kind of go with the flow. You're no worse off, you're just not trying to hold on against all those forces. So letting go of the inner tube analogy. Another aspect of addressing the cause of fear is awakening to what's true. Reality with a capital R, which will be true no matter what happens. And this is, like, thankfully, before I got involved in climate activism, I haven't been involved for several years, but I spent a couple years doing that. And if I had not had some taste of this before doing that, I think I would have been extremely upset and burnt out and freaked out and angry and just terrified. So this is a passage from Dogen's fascicle, Only Buddha and Buddha. An ancient Buddha said, "The entire earth is the true human body. The entire earth is the gate of liberation. The entire earth is the single eye of Vairochana, the universal Buddha, The entire earth is the Dharma body of the self. The true human body means your own true body. Know that the entire earth is your own true body, which is not a temporary body. If someone asks why we do not usually notice this, say, just reflect within yourself that the entire earth is the true human body. Or say, the entire earth is the true human body. You already know this. Also, the entire earth is the gate of liberation means that you are not at all entangled or captivated. What is called the entire earth is intimate, not divided from the moment, the ages, mind, and words. This limitless and boundless experience is the entire earth. So I was going to do some kind of explication of that and go on, but then I just decided to write my own poem in response. You are not your body. You are not your life circumstances. Neither is there a true you, separate from all things, to be discovered in some nook or cranny. You are boundaryless, not separate from all that is, not separate from all that is unfolding. Although the next step you take is entirely up to you, nothing can change what has brought the universe to its present state. Shedding all expectations of what should have been, releasing regrets and anger like rubbish. Deeply inhale this moment and celebrate being alive. In its own being, all things are luminous and miraculous. You too are thus. This is the place to stand when meeting future moments. This is the place of strength, flexibility, and appropriate response. Unassailable because it is groundless. So I still have a few minutes. If there are any thoughts or reflections? Or not. We could just kind of.
Tell me.
Okay, go ahead, Ruthann.
When Obama won the first time he ran, he said immediately, hold my feet to the fire. And I like to say that democracy is not a two-year event. It's participatory. And no matter who wins, I will periodically call our three people in Washington and talk even more about addressing climate disruption, because it's the only home we have, and your poem was beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruthann. Paulette?
Hi, Domeo. I was just curious, I might have missed it, but what was the name of that poem?
The first part I read about the ancient Buddha and the whole entire earth and true human body, that is from Dogen's fascicle Only Buddha and Buddha. Yobutsu Yui Yobutsu. And then afterwards it's just my own thing from.
Thank you.
Okay,
Danny. First of all, I'm sorry. I
Something's happened with the bar on the bottom of my screen, and so there's no, I can't click on the wave. So that's why I've been, and I don't, I just wanted to add something, and it's related to something Ellen said. And I love the poem. I loved everything everybody has said about dealing with fear. But what I'm also having a hard time with is just sadness and grief about the division that has occurred among the people in our country. And I mean, it's something that's happening all over the world. It's not really something that we've never experienced somewhere. But we used to be able to have close elections and talk to people on the other side and have an argument, but then laugh about it. And I have family members and friends who are so different because they're swallowing all of this or accepting all of this violent talk and hatred. And so I've just been using a lot of metta, and I have had a couple of good experiences lately, just being patient and trying to talk to somebody. And it worked once, but it was a great feeling when it worked. And so I just wanted to say that aside from the fear, which is definitely there, if we let our fear take us to the point where we just are also fearful of other people around us, and we can't try anymore, and we can't use metta, and we can't invite them and try to be non-judgmental into a conversation, that's what really scares me. So.
Thank you. That's a great reminder. And one thing that springs to my mind is the Buddha's in the Dhammapada. Hatred ends by non-hatred alone. Like the only way that we can respond is by not responding in kind. And it's very, very hard. And we don't I'm not always proud of like these late night guys that I watch. Sometimes, I don't know, sometimes they say stuff that's just not necessary. It's just kind of mean, and it's like you didn't have to go there. So, even watching in our own speech and behavior, like how can we, and as I wrote in the newsletter too, if we do like Tuesday's outcome, how can we respond in a way that isn't just like we got it over all those,
I think there's going to be a lot of relief. I don't know that.
All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you.
Thanks for being
Bye,
here.
everyone.